You have to help them, Yulian said. Irena's answer was instant. What do you need? Tell me. Yulian replied, Give me some addresses where we can take people who make it to the Aryan side. From there, Jagota could help them. Irena considered, which addresses could she use? There was her apartment. She knew she could count on Zofia and Stanislav. She could count on Yanka and her sister Yaga. We have our emergency rooms, Irena replied. They are open to anyone who flees the ghetto. Can Jagota transmit the addresses to the Jewish Combat Organization? Irena also considered further. She knew it was a daring risk, even more daring than some of their old operations. But if the Germans were hell-bent on destruction street by street, Irena spotted opportunity. Were the Germans distracted enough that she could perhaps get back into the ghetto? She wondered. And if she could get in, surely she could get out with some people. Irena had made it in and out of the ghetto that day, and brought with her a youngster. It could be done. She mobilized her team, and for the next few days the women were once again in and out of the ghetto. Irka Schultz fearlessly rushed into burning buildings and pulled out crying toddlers. Irena waited at sewer manholes and tunnel exits, directing refugees to safe house addresses. At Yanka's apartment, members of the resistance came and went, depositing secret documents being ferried out of the ghetto. Shut off from her friend, Irena was desperately worried for Alla. As the blaze grew fiercer with the passing days, Irena hoped that somehow Alla would be one of those to make it to the shelters. Yulian shared her worry for Alla. Alla was working directly with him and with the others in the Jewish resistance, and Yulian knew her well as a woman of immense resourcefulness and courage. If anyone could survive, it would be Alla. For a week or two, the ruse worked, and families crawled through the sewers to safety. But soon the Germans grew wise to the escape routes. They now shut off all the city utilities and pumped poison into the water and gas mains to kill those escaping. By early May, for those left behind, there was no easy exit. Alla was among those who stayed on, fighting. From burnt-out shelters on opposite sides of Gonsha Street, Alla, Nahum, and Nahum's wife, Henya, tried to help the wounded ghetto fighters with medical services. On May 8, 1943, close to the end, the German patrols raided the bunkers on Gonsha Street. All around Alla, the ghetto was burning. There was no air, only black, choking smoke and heavy, burning heat radiating from the red-hot walls, from the glowing stone stairs, her fellow activist, Marek Edelman, wrote in his diary. The flames cling to our clothes, which now start smoldering. The pavement melts under our feet. Mothers jumped with their small children to their deaths 4 or 5 stories below, amid a hail of German gunfire. Charred corpses lay on the street, and buildings were reduced to rubble. In the underground dirt cellars, the hospital team crouched together fearfully, piling rocks carefully to hide from view their children. But the Germans hunted with dogs now, and one of those dogs betrayed Alla. She could taste the dirt and ash in her mouth, and her legs trembled as they crawled out into the open at gunpoint. They were marched that day together to the assembly point at Nalevsky Street. The path led to the Umschlagplatz. Alla knew what awaited them on the other end of the train line. For 2 days they waited for the train to come. German and Ukrainian soldiers probed the bodies of young men, searching their body cavities for hidden weapons, and around Alla young men were disemboweled and dying. Alla tried not to watch, too, as the prettier girls were raped in turn by a gang of laughing soldiers, followed by the unmistakable ricochet of the gunfire. Perhaps Henya Remba was one of those women. She was young, and there is no known record to show that she ever left Warsaw. Murmurs of pain were silenced with iron cudgels, and then Alla and Nahum were wired into one of the cattle cars destined for Treblinka. On the Aryan side, the burning of the ghetto could be clearly seen from Spientoyerska Street and from Krasinski Square, and there, despite it all, the carnival continued. The partisans did battle until there was no longer a ghetto left to hide in. By May 9th, their number dwindling, the top leader of the Jewish fighting organization, one of several resistance groups in the ghetto, was Marek Edelman. But by May 10th or 11th, there wasn't any drama left for curious Poles to watch, just relentless execution and death by fire. Jewish fighters raised a makeshift plea, scrawled on a bedsheet over the wall toward the Aryan side. "Brother, please help. We fight for our and your freedom." But no help ever came from the Polish masses. Marek and his partisans, men and women, retreated to the buried hillside bunkers, and, in a desperate change of tactics, only came out after darkness for nighttime street fighting. During the days, the ghetto was eerily quiet, and the ever-present whisper of flames, and sometimes beams crashing, were the only sounds heard. The fighters ran out of water and ammunition. The only goal in the last days was not to be taken alive by the Germans. Trapped in hideouts that would be their crypts, families and resistance leaders pulled out from their last precious possessions, their cyanide pills, and committed suicide together. Only a handful of the Warsaw ghetto fighters escaped death and transport to the camps. These were the fighters who managed to slip, undetected, to the Aryan side in the last days of the revolt. There were fewer than 200 of them. But Marek Edelman was one of them. He remembered later how, with the ghetto collapsing around them, a few strong and lucky fighters, men and women, half-walked, half-crawled for 20 hours, through sewers booby-trapped by the Germans, squeezing themselves through fetid pipes just over 2 feet in diameter in darkness. On the other side, trucks and comrades, ready to rush away to the forests or safe houses, waited for them. At one of those grates, Irena stood sentinel. At 8:15 p.m. on May 16th, just as dusk settled over Warsaw, a colossal blast of dynamite shook windows as far as the Aryan Quarter. The great synagogue shuddered for a moment and then crumbled. It was the last symbolic defeat of the Jews of Warsaw. The battle for the ghetto was over. The German governor-general of the city informed his superiors in Berlin that his mission was accomplished. Jews, bandits, and subhumans were destroyed. The Jewish quarter of Warsaw is no more. Only the bombed-out steeple tower of St. Augustine's Church rose up forlornly in the center of a sea of concrete and brick rubble. The governor-general proudly reported that the total number of Jews destroyed in the Aktion, at the death camps or by fire, totaled 56,065 out of a population of perhaps 60,000. And for those Jews in hiding on the Aryan side of the city, life now became, though it was hard to believe it, infinitely more precarious. Many in hiding outside of the ghetto now despaired of survival. Constant terror took a psychic toll from which some would never recover. Faced with the chance of fleeing, some Jewish men and women now took fantastic gambles. One of those men was Irene's old friend, the attorney Yusef Zisman. When Yusef and his family escaped the ghetto at the end of 1942, the Hotel Polski was a seedy four-story building at number 29 Dwuga Street, located just outside the ghetto boundary. On the ground floor was a restaurant, and the stairs above led to rooms with narrow rectangular windows overlooking the cobbled avenue. Since his escape, Yusef had been moving from one apartment safe house to another, and the family had separated for safety. Irena was looking after little Piotr, and Theodora was living now with false papers. By the late spring of 1943, Yusef was lonely and tired. Schmaltzofniks stalked the city, ferreting out hidden Jews for extortion and the German bounty. They searched for small clues of someone in hiding. The play of shadows against an attic window at twilight, or an extra loaf of bread in a housewife's basket. Then his guardians would come to Yusef, frantic, and he would flee to the streets at a moment's notice, again homeless. Yusef wandered, trying to think of where he could go to sleep just for a few hours. He missed his family, He missed his life. He knew that he could not carry on in this state of constant terror. It was sometime in the second or third week of May that Yusef first heard a wild rumor. The occupiers, someone whispered to Yusef, were willing to exchange Jews for German citizens abroad, and the Jews would be sent out of Poland on regular train service. Soon the rumors took on an even more fantastic dimension. People said now, at the underground cafes where Jews on the run learned to go for news and coffee, that a long-awaited ration of visas and passports for foreign-born Jews and Jews wanting to emigrate to South America and Palestine had arrived in Warsaw from the embassies abroad. The papers arrived too late to save their intended recipients. The Umschlagplatz had claimed nearly all of them. But that didn't mean these visas and passports couldn't save someone, although salvation would come at black market prices. Behind it all were an unscrupulous Jewish profiteer named Adam Juravin and a ghetto gangster named Leon Lolek Skosovsky. No one knew quite how, but during the ghetto uprising, they had come into possession of an astonishing cache of undelivered mail, which included hundreds of emigration papers. Adam, the whisperers at the underground cafes said, managed a small hotel at number 29 Dwuga Street. You could go there to buy a passport. The fees, naturally, were staggering. Only rich Jews who had saved something of their pre-war fortunes would be able to pay Adam Zuravin's prices, although that did not stop desperate and impoverished families from trying. Rumor had it, too, that the hotel was being set up as a kind of neutral staging ground, a place where Jews could register for emigration and wait safely until the papers were processed and the deportations out of Poland started. Yusef watched and waited. But it was true. The first arrivals registered for visas, and they were told that they would have to be patient. They checked into sunlit rooms on the upper stories, and the Germans didn't come to arrest them. In fact, it seemed like some kind of paradise. Inside the confines of the hotel corridors and rooms, the residents were granted unimaginable freedom. Here, Jews didn't have to wear the Star of David, and the Gestapo too studiously, some said, ignored the building. A small patch of cobblestone in front of the main entrance was declared a patio for the café-restaurant, and from the street corner, Yusef could plainly see for himself well-dressed Jews enjoying coffee, unmolested in the late spring sunshine. People came and went, and at night the neighborhood rang with the sounds of the wildest, most joyous parties at the Hotel Polski. Women pulled out their hidden fur coats and their mother's pearls and walked the corridors with a swish of satin. Amorous couples, desirous of nothing as much as life and this freedom, staggered tipsily through the corridors, oblivious to the fate of others. At the Hotel Polski, it was miracle after miracle. Still, Yusef was watchful. But he was also growing desperate. On May 21st, even the naysayers and the doubters were silenced. That morning, 64 Jews from the hotel, with no SS guards and with great politeness from the Germans, boarded a well-equipped and comfortable train destined for the camp at Vittel, on the eastern border of France, where conditions were known to be civilized. On the train, even the children had their own seats and waved a cheerful goodbye to Warsaw from the gleaming windows. Those who boarded inevitably included those willing to pay the largest bribes. Some families paid 750,000 zlotyk, something over $2 million, for one of the precious passports. Many families paid 20,000 or 30,000 zlotyk for single documents that might help in an application. When letters arrived from Vittel that the recipients knew were authentic, confirming safe arrivals and good conditions, things went crazy. More than 2,500 Jewish people rushed from their hiding places on the Aryan side. Some figures put the number as high as 3,500. They all came to jockey for a place on the list of emigrants, to roll the dice in what even those going there understood was the war's most spectacular and dangerous lottery. Irene's friend, the Jewish attorney Yusef Zisman, was among them. It wasn't that Yusef believed the Germans so much as he had lost faith in his chances of survival on the run. For hiding Jewish men was much, much harder than hiding mothers or children. And for some reason, perhaps it was pride, perhaps it was the sense that he had already asked too much by giving her Pyotr, Yusef didn't reach out to Irene. He didn't believe he could last on the Aryan side much longer, and if there was any chance, it was worth the wild gamble. The Polish underground tried to warn Jews that it was a trap. Urgent messages buzzed across all their secret networks. But the Jews who went could not be persuaded. Hope was too powerful. For months, a fantasy world had taken hold at the Hotel Polski, and the party went on until the gangsters were confident that the last pockets of hidden wealth were exhausted. The Hotel Polski was nothing more than a cruel opportunity, arranged between the Gestapo and a handful of Jewish collaborators, to strip Warsaw's Jewry of its last remaining resources. Among those Jewish collaborators and the architects of this tissue of rumor was a woman whom Irene and Yusef knew well from the ghetto. She was the sultry cabaret singer who crooned old love songs at the smoke-filled Café Stuka, and she was Alla's cousin, Viera Gran. Irene was convinced that Viera was a Gestapo informer. Irene wasn't the only one. Many of those closest to Irene saw evidence of Viera's treachery. Secret files of the Home Army warned its agents that Viera Gran, quote, Jewess before the war, a cabaret dancer, now leads an office of the confidants of the Gestapo, who are occupied mainly in hunting for Jews. At Szigota, Dr. Adolf Behrmann saw her as a Nazi collaborator. So did Alla's young friend, the now-celebrated ghetto hero Marek Edelman. Jonas Turkov, the Jewish actor whom Alla and Nachum had saved at the Umschlagplatz, claimed to have witnessed her betrayals directly. Asked later to describe the singer, whom she had watched perform that night with Alla in the ghetto nightclub in the days before the Great Action, Irene was blunt in her assessment of Alla's cousin. Viera Gran, a cabaret actress, worked for the Gestapo along with Leon Skosowski. It hurt me a great deal that among the list of great people of the Jewish nation, Viera Gran was among them, a criminal who sold out her own people. One of those Viera was rumored to have sold out that year was Yosef Zisman. He presented himself that spring, along with those thousands of others, at the shabby front desk of the Hotel Polski. He handed over whatever sums that registration required. And for weeks, Yusef passed his days pacing up and down the tired hallways, his last resources dwindling rapidly amid the scenes of jubilant chaos. At last, one morning in July, someone excitedly spread the word. They were leaving. The trains were coming. It seemed so civilized to Yusef in the beginning. Jews calmly boarded the trains, expecting to head west, to life and freedom. How long was it before those on board realized that the tracks only led to the concentration camps at Bergen-Belsen? And when the trains could not take them all, and the Gestapo was eager to be done with the affair, those who remained, several hundred, were taken to the notorious Pawiak prison in the ruins of the ghetto. Some were lined up against the elm tree in the courtyard and executed in a hail of gunfire. Others were led opposite the prison gate to Jelna Street, to where a rough wooden platform stretched out over the abyss of a burnt-out foundation. As shots rang out, bodies tumbled from that parapet into a mass grave filled with jumbled quicklime-covered bodies. Among the victims of the Hotel Polski was Yusef Zisman. A wonderful man, died a martyr's death, dishonorably deceived by barbarians. That was Irene's indictment. Irene and her friends would not forget the role of Viera Gran in his murder. Viera protested her innocence. Irene was not persuaded. After the war, there would be consequences and more allegations. There would be trials and recriminations, and Irene would bear testimony against Viera personally. Something else astonishing and heartbreaking made its way that summer back to Warsaw, through the channels of Żegota and the underground too, and surely its leader, Julian Grobelny, shared the news with Irena. A determined group of Jewish fighters, caught up in the deportations to Treblinka in the last days of the ghetto uprising, had been sent on to a slave labor camp at a place called Poniatowa. There, the prisoners were set to work fabricating German military uniforms for the textile magnate Walter Tubbins. And most of those saved from the gas chambers were Jews who had been assigned to his factories inside the ghetto. Henya Kopel, the mother of baby Bieta, was one of them. Now word was coming that a dozen or so among them were organizing within the camp, a resistance cell, and an underground railroad. Someone among them got word to Marek Edelman's organization. They needed urgent help to keep on fighting. Someone in the cell got a message to Julian Grobelny at Żegota as well. Among their number, Julian learned, was a woman, a nurse, who had already set up at the camp a secret medical clinic and a children's youth circle. Her team needed false identity papers, money, and, once again, weapons. Operations had begun to smuggle out the children with the aid of local Żegota operatives. Then they planned to stage a mass prison escape and another Jewish uprising. That nurse was Alla. 1943 was a year of great tragedy and moral darkness in Warsaw. But there were also amazing stories of survival and struggle, Alla's and others. That autumn there was another dramatic rescue of a child whose life would be tied forever to Irena's story. Chaya Estera Stein was the first of Irena's own two foster daughters. Once again, it was Julian Grobelny who made the connection. Estera came from the village of Segwów, not far from Warsaw, and in 1940, the year Estera turned 13, she was interned in the ghetto in Mroża, with her parents Aaron and Feige and her little sister Jadzia. In 1942, the Mroża ghetto was liquidated. Aaron, Feige, and Estera fled the roundups with their lives and huddled together that first night in an old garden shed on a farm outside the village. But little Jadzia had been left behind in the chaos alone, and her mother was frantic. Aaron laid his hand on his wife's shoulder and promised he was returning to the ghetto. He would find her. For days, the mother and daughter waited in the shadows. Then Feige understood that Aaron and Jadzia were never returning. Feige looked at her hungry and tired daughter. They couldn't stay in a garden shed forever. In the darkness, Feige crept for help to the only person in the village she could think might help them. Aaron owned a factory, and his business was making soda water. Julian Grobelny owned one of the large farms in the village, perhaps even the farm where Estera and her mother were hiding. Julian and Aaron were great friends, both with each other and with the local priest in the parish church. Estera's image of her father was always one of him and the priest walking together, her Orthodox Jewish father with his long beard and black gabardine coat, and the priest in his swaying cassock. When Feige knocked on the door of the parish house, the old priest gave her food and water and promised he would help her. But Feige did not survive the return journey. She was captured and murdered. The priest sent urgent word to Julian that they would have to hurry if they were to save Estera. Julian turned, as always, to Irena, the director of Żegota's child welfare cell, who sent a courier to the priest with new identity papers. Estera's new Aryan name was now Teresa Tucholska, and she would have to travel alone on the train to Warsaw. Anything else was too dangerous. The priest walked Estera to the train station and showed her which compartment to enter, and when the Germans asked to see her papers, Estera remembered what to say perfectly. The railway station in Warsaw was crowded and noisy, but on the platform, a small blonde woman waited for her patiently. Irena touched the girl's shoulder reassuringly. "Come along then, Teresa." And the next few days, Estera stayed with Irena and her mother in the small apartment in Wola, during those dangerous first hours of transition. Estera was an independent and clever girl, but in the space of weeks she had lost her entire family, and Irena found herself wishing for the first time that she had babies. Despite what Irena wished, Estera could not stay on in her apartment. Liaisons and resistance couriers came and went, and it was too dangerous for a child already. At last, Irena hit upon the perfect solution. She would send Estera to Zofia and Stanislav, her old friends from the Polish Free University, and both activists in the cells of Dr. Radlinska's underground networks. Zofia and Stanislav had four children of their own, and they were already hiding in their apartment at number 9 Lekarska Street in the Ochota district, three additional Jewish youngsters. Of course they would hide Estera, they assured Irena, and Teresa would become the eighth child in their wartime family. It was just in time. Soon Irena wouldn't be in a position to safely take care of anyone. It was Irena who, in the fall of 1943, would desperately need saving. Chapter 14. Aleya Shuha, Warsaw, October 1943 to January 1944. Bratska Street was just off a main thoroughfare to the east of where the ghetto had stood, and its busy storefronts included a laundry shop, where housewives could get some relief if they had the money to spare. Women came and went all day there, picking up neatly wrapped brown paper parcels or linens piled in baskets. Sometimes, though, the women came and went bringing something else, a note or a message, tucked among the folds of garments. In October 1943, the Gestapo arrested the woman who ran the shop, accusing her of aiding the resistance by passing parcels and messages. Taken to Shuha Avenue and tortured, brutalized at Paviak, and interrogated again with iron bars and truncheons, the broken and wretched woman gave the Gestapo what information she knew. She was almost certainly executed afterward. There was no way to blame someone in these circumstances. No one knew whether they would be able to withstand torture until faced with one's executioners. When she cracked, she named at least three women who used her shop as an underground postbox. One of them was Irena Sendler. On the evening of October 19th, Irena and her family gathered for a small party. One of her aunts had come and spent the night with her mother. So too had Irena's friend and her underground liaison, Yanka Grabowska. Yanka and her husband, Yusef, were a couple whom many people trusted to keep their secrets. They were hiding for some members of the Jewish Fighting Organization important files and archives, and they were also still hiding their friend, a woman who was, perhaps, something even more to Adam and his family, Regina Mickelberg, along with her sister. Neither Yanka nor Irena had forgotten Regina's dramatic escape from the rail cars rolling toward Treblinka, or the old ties of college friendship that connected them to each other and to Adam, no matter how complicated Irena's most private emotions. After the cakes and cordials, the mother and aunt retired to bed, but Yanka and Irena stayed up talking until long after curfew. It was nearly 2 in the morning, in fact, before the younger women settled down to sleep on makeshift beds in the living room. Before letting herself drift off to sleep, Irena carefully did what she always did as a precaution. She placed the current card files with the names and the addresses of dozens of Jewish children in the center of the kitchen table underneath the window. She tucked her weathered work bag, which held some blank identity papers and a large sum of money, by the side of her bed for safekeeping. Then she dozed lightly. At just after 3 a.m., the pounding started. Her mother, Yanina, suffering from a heart condition that left her tossing fitfully, had awoken moments earlier, and her whispered alarm had given Irena the precious few moments she needed to clear her fuzzy head and spring into action. The agents roared at the door, screaming, "Open! Gestapo!" A pry bar scratched at the door, and there was the sound of cracking. Irena had practiced her routine many times. She had prepared for this eventuality. She grabbed the lists and moved swiftly toward the window. As she was about to lift the sash, her heart stopped. Below were more Gestapo agents, gazing malignantly up at her. Jesus, 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 what was she going to do now? Irina scanned the room hopelessly. There was nowhere safe to hide the lists. As the pounding on the door grew more furious and the door began to give way, she tossed them desperately to Yanka. This is a list of our children. Hide it somewhere. Save it. It cannot fall into the hands of the Gestapo. She had time to see Yanka stuff the list into her bra before the door clattered open. 11 Gestapo agents swarmed forward, and behind them, Irina saw the horror-stricken face of Mr. Przezdzicki, the building manager. The men went wild. The agents stood above her, inches away, and screamed threats and orders at her. In their frenzy, they destroyed the apartment. They tore apart the insides of the stove looking for hidden materials, pulled up the floorboards, threw dishes from the cupboards. It was all calculated for maximum effect, and Irina had to admit that it worked. She was frightened. The search went on for 3 heart-stopping hours, and there was something almost surreal about how it all unfolded. Irina didn't believe in miracles, but as the Gestapo began tearing apart the mattress of her makeshift bed, she watched in awe as the rickety frame collapsed on top of the bag sitting there in plain view, with all the identity documents and cash inside. Irina could not believe it. The Germans had just hidden from themselves the most incriminating of all the evidence. All the while, they battered Irina and her visitors with questions. Irina at last convinced the agents that Yanka was an innocent out-of-town visitor, like Irina's aunt, although in fact Yanka was practically a neighbor. Her mother, the agents saw plainly, was too ill to be engaged in the underground. So that left only Irina. At 6 a.m., the agents wrapped up their search, and the agent in charge barked at Irina to dress quickly. Pulling on her skirt in a rush and trying to quickly button up her sweater, Irina's heart felt lighter than she ever could have imagined. If they were letting her get dressed, they were done searching. If they were done searching, they hadn't discovered the lists. And if they weren't there for Yanka, they didn't know about Yaga's apartment or the sisters' collaboration with her. Her eyes met Yanka's, but Irina didn't risk a smile. All she wanted was to get out of the apartment before the Gestapo could reconsider. As the agents led her into the corridor, their heavy boots echoed in the stairwell. Along the hallway, Irina knew that the neighbors were listening at their doors in silence. A few moments later, it would be chaos and gossip. A prison car waited outside, its engine already running. Yanka dashed down the walkway at the last moment, a dangerous impulse. In her hands, Irina saw her shoes. She will need them. Please. The men just nodded, bored, and gestured to Irina to get on with it. Irina knew her destination. The sedan was cramped, and Irina was pressed inside, onto the lap of one of the young Gestapo agents. The doors slammed closed and the car lurched into motion. She supposed she had always known this moment would come, but she realized suddenly she hadn't been prepared for it. The sun wasn't yet up over Warsaw, and in the half-light of morning, the agents closest to her dozed lightly. Irina tried to think calmly, rationally. Yanka knew how important the lists were, and she would surely hide them. She understood how things stood. There was no chance, realistically, of Irina surviving. As the car turned south to join the broad boulevards, Irina thought of Dr. Radlinska and her dozens of sleeping conspirators scattered across the city. At least she desperately hoped they were sleeping. She thought of Adam. Would she be strong enough to keep his secret? There was no point in pretending. Something terrible was coming next. She knew that. Was there pain enough in the world that would lead her to betray Adam's hiding place? Was there enough to make her betray Yaga or Yanka or the children? What about Adam's Jewish wife? Would she die to protect her also? Irena thought she could bear it. But most could not stand the torture. She must steel her nerves. She would die in silence. As long as her friends and the children survived, she told herself, she could suffer anything. That was what everyone said at the beginning. As they approached the final turn, Irena slipped her hands into her coat pockets to warm them for a final few moments. The jolt of fear came like a knife in her heart. A list. Addresses. She had forgotten last night to take it out of her jacket. On a small roll of cigarette paper was scratched the details of one of the safe houses. Irena rode the rising tide of panic for a moment. There was no time left. They were nearing Zhuhua. The young man on whose lap she was perched, surely his breathing meant he was dozing. Quietly, gently, she rolled and shredded the tissue paper into balls in her pocket. Its flimsy texture gave way quickly. If nothing else, it would smudge the writing. Watching the heads of the nearest agents bobbing and swaying with the car's motion, she was nearly certain they were sleeping. What else could she do but this one last gamble? She lifted her hand gently to the open window and let the tiny bullets flutter free. The agent beneath her twitched and snorted, and then nothing. Irena leaned her head against the window and closed her eyes, too, but with tears streaming down her face. The slaughterhouse. That was what people on the streets of Warsaw called the squat gray compound on Zhuhua Avenue. Steel chains and locks studded the iron gates that rose up before Irena, and the guards wore ugly whips slung at their hips and high black boots with a glossy polish. A bored officer brusquely hustled Irena toward the anteroom. Beyond the doorway, she could make out the contours of a large room where interrogations were conducted. She was pushed along quickly for registration into a small room where a typewriter clanged and the radio played German music. She waited. Soon she was led into another room where a tall German man asked her questions in perfect Polish. His manner was smooth and gentle. Irena knew that the intention was deadly. What was her name? Where did she live? Who was her family? Those were easy questions, questions to which the Gestapo already had the answers. But before long the questions moved on to more perilous ground. We know you are helping the resistance and the Jews, Pani Sendler. What organization are you working for? It will be better for you. They knew about Julian Grobelna. They were hunting for this elusive man, Konrad Zsigota. They knew about the underground postbox at the laundry. The thickness of the man's file made her start feeling very frightened. She prayed they did not know about Adam. She protested that she knew nothing. It was all a misunderstanding. She was a social worker, and that brought her into contact with many people, naturally. But if someone in her circle was doing something wrong, she knew nothing about it. The agent gave her a thin smile and arched his eyebrow. He had seen it all before. These people always protested their innocence in the beginning. Torture had a way of getting them talking. She was choosing the hard way. So be it, Pani Sendler. We will talk further, I promise. Another guard pushed Irena along the corridor afterward. The tunes still drifted from the radio. It was early and everything else was silent. Before long the transfers from Pavyak would be arriving, and the hallways would echo with footsteps and weeping. The ceilings there were low and the corridor narrow. Irena passed four cells, each with iron grates and a row of narrow wooden benches, and at one of them the door was pushed open. Others sat silently with slumped shoulders, and no one turned as she entered, stumbling. "Sit," came the stern order. "You are to look only at the back of the head in front of you. No speaking." Irena smelled fear and dampness. They were all new arrivals, sleepless and worried. The narrow bench was hard and too low to be comfortable. The ground beneath her shoe was sticky. Blood. A wave of dizziness flooded over her. For a time, Irena and the others sat motionless. Just after 8 a.m., the transports arrived and the benches around her filled with strangers. The radio stopped playing, and now names were called. Soon cries of terror came from the hallway, the distant sounds of things being thrown, dull thuds, and then the cries of bodies being broken. Sometimes there was gunfire. Interrogations took place on the upper floors or in the basement, but the doors and windows were left open as an inducement to the others waiting to assess their options carefully. Said one survivor of those morning rituals at Shuha Avenue, one could hear curt questions, the murmur of low answers again and again and again, the sound of blows, after which came a shriek, often a woman's sob, clutching at our hearts and impeding our breathing. There was another prison tradition. On the first day of their arrest, prisoners were severely beaten. Often one savage session did the trick. By the second or third day, many proved more pliable and willing. Irena would never talk of the abuse she suffered that day or in the days that followed, but others remembered the abuses at Paviak with horror. There were blows to the face with fists and boots that left eyes hanging from sockets, and bone-shattering strikes with rubber truncheons. Soldering irons burned the flesh of breasts and faces. Shoulders were dislocated. Afterward, the limp and bloodied inmates were thrown back into the cells and ordered to sit at attention until the covered prison trucks that would transport them to Paviak rolled through the gates. On October 20, 1943, Irena was among those bruised and beaten bodies. Inside the darkness of the transport van that first afternoon, she tried to push the pain and fear from her mind as the truck sped across the city, its horns blaring a disconsolate refrain. But every movement was agony. At Paviak, a prison guard marched Irena down broad stone stairs. Those who could not stand were hauled along, and a handful of grim-faced nurses and doctors pulled the most dangerously beaten from the truck and loaded them, moaning, onto canvas army stretchers. Officially, Paviak was the prison for political figures, academics, students, doctors, and those in the resistance and illegal universities, the intelligentsia. But in practice, it was a notorious black site prison, and there was no legal process. One-third of those who arrived that afternoon with Irena would face execution. Most of the others would perish after being sent away on the late-night transports that left the prisoners at Paviak in a constant state of terror. Those destined for the concentration camps of Ravensbrück and Auschwitz were hauled into the prison courtyard after lights out, and, in the darkness, pummeled with rifle butts by furious guards, then loaded on coaches handcuffed to one another. Irena understood. Death was how this ended. At Paviak, Irena was shocked to see old friends and conspirators among the inmates. In her cell that first night, Irena and her neighbor, Basha Dietrich, grasped hands silently in the darkness. In an urgent whispered conversation, long after lights out, Basha told Irena that another friend, Helena Pechchin, had also been arrested. Helena was a history school teacher. Basha and Irena had lived nearby for years in the same apartment complex in Vola, where Basha was a scout leader and still ran the community kindergarten. Irena had known Basha since those first days as a young newlywed with Mietek. Unofficially, though, Basha was a captain in a resistance movement known as the Powstańcze Oddziały Specjalne Jerzyki, the Insurgent Special Forces SWIFTs, a group of dedicated men and women who ran, in parallel to Irena's network, an operation rescuing several hundred Jewish children from the ghetto. Helena was Basha's operational partner. By the spring of 1943, when the insurgent special forces were combined with home army operations and became part of the sprawling and diffuse underground movement that included Żegota, their group was in regular contact with Irena. The next morning, Irena made contact with another friend inside the prison. Jadwiga Jędrzejowska was alive! She could not believe it. Jadwiga Jędrzejowska was another of Dr. Radlińska's girls from before the war, a few years older than Irena and her close circle, but Irena recognized her instantly. Jadwiga and her Jewish boyfriend Horak joined the resistance immediately after the occupation started, working in the underground press movement, and for 3 years they eluded the Gestapo. But in 1942, the two were arrested. Horak was shot, and for a year Jadwiga languished in prison, assigned at first, despite her medical training, to cleaning latrines and offices. But in the prison there was an astonishing resistance taking shape, and soon Jadwiga was pulled into the network. Two husband and wife teams were at the heart of this underground cell. Dr. Anna Szipowicz, a dentist, and her medical doctor husband, Dr. Witold Szipowicz, and Dr. Zygmunt Szliwicki, a physician, and his wife, the prison head nurse, Anna Szliwicka. All four were members of the Polish resistance. Like Irena, the women were in their early 30s and fearless. At 9 a.m. on the second day of her incarceration, Irena stood with the others at attention. Breakfast, a bit of moldy bread and ersatz coffee, was over. So were the 8:30 a.m. calls for the day's executions. As the stricken women were led out for the last time, Irena dropped her eyes to the ground. She could not bear to watch this. Above her scuffed shoes, she felt the red welts rising along her ankles where bedbugs crawled over her in the night, and even moving her head made her face throb where the first German blows had fallen. The 9 a.m. roll calls were for patients ordered to the medical clinics. Irena's mind wandered. Her head jerked up as she heard Jadwiga Jędrzejowska's voice call out Irena's name for the dentistry office. Dentist? Irena started to say, I don't need to see the dentist. Then it flashed upon her. It was a message. Irena stepped forward wordlessly and followed. The window of the cramped office into which she was led looked out over the ruins of the ghetto. It was hard to forget what she had witnessed there. Eva, Dr. Korczak, Rachela, Alla, Yusef. As far as she could see, it was a sea of rubble and stone and burnt-out ruins of foundations. When the prison dentist, Dr. Anna Szipowicz, slipped into the room, Irena realized she also knew Anna from pre-war activist circles. What a relief to be among friends! Irena started to speak, but Anna quickly put up a finger and gestured to the dentist chair before her. Irena nodded. In order not to raise suspicion, Anna would have to drill a hole and fill a cavity that had never existed. But Irena, in the dentist chair, understood at last when Anna passed her a grips, a secret wadded prison message. It was from Julian Grabelna, Trojan, and the message was simple. We are doing everything we can to get you out of that hell. On the tissue-thin paper that Anna held out to her, Irena scribbled back the only return message that mattered. The lists are safe. As long as Irena did not break under the torture, no one knew the location of the hidden children. What Irena didn't tell Julian Grabelna, of course, was that the lists were with Janka. It would have been too great a risk if the message were intercepted. It would turn out to be an amazingly lucky decision. Over the next days and weeks, there were more trips to Szucha, just as her German interrogator had promised. Some mornings when the rolls were read after breakfast, calling forward those destined for transport and torture, Irena's heart clenched to hear her name among them. Before long, the bones of Irena's legs and feet were broken, and there were scars and ugly open wounds running in jagged strips across her body that would mark her forever. All that saved Irena from being beaten to death on those days was the fact that the Germans didn't have any idea whom they had captured. The Gestapo thought Irena was a small player, a foolish young woman dabbling at the periphery of the Polish resistance. They had no inkling yet that they had captured one of its most senior leaders, or a woman responsible for hiding thousands of Jewish children across the city. But they would not be ignorant of this fact forever. Through the pain, Irena reasoned with herself silently, Some days the torture seemed bearable, and with enough concentration, she could sometimes float away from her poor, miserable body. Other times the beatings were fierce, and the darkness lapped at the edges of her consciousness. Was she prepared to die to save the others? She knew she had it in her power to bring about the deaths of thousands. She repeated over and over her story. She was just a social worker. She knew nothing. She refused to let herself think of Adam. To even think of Adam might mean his name would slip out unbidden as she fell to the floor under the blows. Twice a day, at noon and in the evening, the vans carted the broken bodies back to Paviak. One could have an impression that this was an ambulance carrying victims of a disaster, one of the doctors remembered. Their faces were pale and covered in blood, with black eyes, clothes crumpled and soiled, often with sleeves and pockets torn off. Some days Irena was among them. Other days she worked in the prison laundry, standing long hours on fractured and painful limbs that were healing badly, scrubbing feces from stained German underwear in between the torture. She limped painfully now, and the daily walks around the prison courtyard were an agony. When the job in the laundry was not done to the German's satisfaction, the punishments were sadistic. One afternoon, a furious guard lined the laundry women up against the wall and, walking down the row, put a bullet through the head of every other person. Irena, that day, was one of the survivors. On the morning of Irena's arrest, as word spread, there was panic. Julian Grobelna and the leadership at Zsigota faced one set of concerns, the most important of which was the lists and the addresses of the children. If Irena were executed, the information about the lists would perish with her. Thousands of children, many of whom were too young to remember their own identities, would be lost forever to their families and to the Jewish nation. But there was also a far bigger risk that Irena posed to those children. Irena put it bluntly. They weren't just worried about me. They didn't know whether I could stand the torture. After all, I knew where all the children were. If Irena broke, it would be an unparalleled disaster. But saving her was an immense challenge. It would mean bribing someone at the very highest levels of the Gestapo. At Maria Kukulska's house in Praga, the problems were different. And the residents were asking themselves the same questions. Could Irena withstand the torture? What did the Germans know already? Janka Grabowska passed word of the arrest to Maria and Adam, but she could only advise them to be prepared for what might happen. Jurek was still courting Maria Kukulska's daughter, Anna, and the moment he stepped through the door of the apartment that day, he knew something was terribly wrong. Maria's home was usually a place of laughter and a warm welcome, but Adam sat slumped in a chair staring ahead blankly. Jurek wasn't sure that he even saw him. Adam did not turn. He said nothing. Jurek knew in a flash that it was Irena. Anna quickly signaled for Jurek to follow her. "Irena?" he asked. Anna nodded. "She's at Shuha, and perhaps already in Paviak," she told him. "There are efforts to get her out." Jurek felt close to collapsing. Irena had guided everything, kept all of them safe. What now? When Adam roused himself at last, it was to insist against all reason that they would save Irena. "We will get her out. That's all there is to it." Head in his hands, he said it over and over. Maria didn't dare to tell him that it was surely hopeless. People didn't leave Paviak. Not in the way that Adam wanted. Gently, Maria broached at last an even more painful problem, a more urgent question that she needed Adam to consider. Would Irena betray them under torture? How much did the Gestapo know already? The apartment here was burnt, no longer safe for hiding. Adam would have to flee now to another hiding place. "Adam, we need to go now." Worried about Adam and unwilling to leave him alone anywhere, Maria could see only one solution. Adam would need to travel to the safe house on Akatsiova Street in Otvotsk, where Zhogota leader Yulian Grabelna and his wife Halina were hiding. The boy Yerzhe would stay with them also. Moving a man who looked as strongly Jewish as Adam was perilous. It was risky for him to be seen too close to the window. Now he was going to walk through the streets of Warsaw? Take a streetcar to the suburbs unnoticed? There was no option. That autumn afternoon, for the first time in more than a year, Adam Selnikyer walked with Maria Kukulska down the stairs of the apartment and onto the streets of a changed Warsaw. Maria insisted on traveling with Adam personally on the journey to Otwock. The streets of Praga were quiet, but as they neared the depot, the crowds grew thicker, and Maria felt only rage when at her side two Polish men blocked their way forward.
"A Jew! Here's a Jew!"
One of the men held out a hand for money. "I hope you are rich, Pani. Otherwise it's the Gestapo." Maria turned on the man with wild fury.
"Leave us alone," she hissed, "or I will have the Home Army execute you."
It was not an idle threat in the autumn of 1943, although admitting that one had contacts in the resistance was also an immense danger. The Polish underground state had a mirror justice system that was running at full tilt now, and judicial executions of collaborators and blackmailers were common. The blackmailers exchanged a quick look and slid away in search of easier targets. Maria's bluster, astonishingly, had succeeded. At the safe house in Otwock, Yulian and Halina Grabelna welcomed Adam as an old friend, and at the hideout people were always coming and going in secret. Yulian was quiet in the eye of the storm, but around him constantly were movement and urgent whispers. By now Yulian was bedridden and struggled for words. His cheeks had been hollowed out by tuberculosis. Halina tended him carefully with a cheerful smile, but he was dying. Beyond Pawiak, things were changing quickly for the others in Irena's network at the end of October, too, and it would not take long for word of this to reach Yulian Grabelna. Southeast of Warsaw, at the slave labor camp at Poniatowa, where 15,000 prisoners struggled for survival, the prison resistance movement was growing stronger. Baby Bieta's mother, Henia Koppel, was still alive and laboring as a seamstress. So was the indefatigable Ala Golom Grinberg. Ala was already part of a small camp cell working in direct contact with Marek Edelman's fighting organization and Zhogota. The ringleaders were carefully planning a daring escape. Camp uprisings were now plaguing the Germans. In August, the arrivals at Treblinka revolted, and there were incursions even at Auschwitz that autumn. The revolts were put down with brutal force, but by the fall of 1943, things were not going so well for the Germans in the war, and Berlin was nervous. At the end of the month, their attention turned to Poniatowa. Suddenly, a couple of hundred laborers were pulled from the textile factories and set to work in the fields, building deep, zigzagging defensive trenches, 2 meters deep, to fortify the compound. Work went on for days, and word was that the next detail would be the construction of air raid towers. Ala and those in her cell, however, grew increasingly suspicious and watchful. Ala and her cell already had a small arsenal of weapons, smuggled into the camp with the help of Zhogota, and when the Germans ordered a dawn roll call of all the prisoners on the morning of November 4th, Ala knew with a sinking heart that something terrible was coming. The cell leaders, men and women who had fought together in the ghetto uprising, and members of the Jewish resistance, huddled together and quickly made a bold decision. The fighters would not report for the roll call. They gathered instead in one of the barracks and set up the barricades ready for defensive military action. The cache of weapons was tiny, but these were already men and women who had seen firsthand what was possible. Along the trenches, in freezing November morning temperatures, the Germans now called the prisoners forward in groups of 50. At gunpoint, they stripped off their clothing and placed their valuables in small baskets. Then nearly 15,000 slave laborers lay down together, amid machine gun fire and barking dogs, in the trenches,
and were executed in mass graves in an action the Germans had codenamed Erntefest, the Harvest Festival. The executions went on for days. Henja Koppel was 24 when she died in the harvest.